You're listening to the Fat Dude Digs Flicks Movie Podcast Network. What is up, everybody? This is Andy, the resident fat dude of Fat Dude Digs Flicks, coming to you recorded from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and it is time for an all-new Let's Taco Bout. If this is your first time listening to Let's Talk About, hello, welcome. Thank you so much for listening. Let's Talk About is an interview show where I am joined by a guest. We talk about their life, their loves, and a movie that has had an impact on them. Let me apologize for the delay in getting this episode out. You know, sometimes it's hard to want to do things. And the challenge for me, like, this past week or so has just been like, you know, work life is sometimes challenging, and it makes you like not want to do anything regular life. And that's what I'm going to blame this on. I'm going to blame this on a tough week of work, and not really wanting to do anything else. But here we are. I'm here now, and I'm a little bit back on schedule, so that's cool. No idea what's going to happen next week, as far as an episode is concerned. I've got nothing scheduled. So, hey, if you're listening and you want to be on the show and haven't been on before, please send an email to fatdudediggsflicks@gmail.com. I'd love to have you on the show. This is probably going to be the longest preamble to the episode in a long time. And maybe, possibly ever, just because I've got stuff I want to say before I get things started. I saw some movies in the theater. I did a double feature last week, and one of those movies was really good. I had a really great time. The other one was decent. Then I watched a movie at home that was terrible. So that's kind of where we're at with those. I'll talk about those movies really quickly. I saw Evil Dead Rise, the new film in the Evil Dead franchise. It was awesome. Like, I just thought it was wonderful. Gory, kind of mean-spirited, but really, really cool. A really enjoyable watch. Yeah, I had a really good time with that one. I thought it was nice to kind of see practical gore effects done in such a way that really like made you question how they do that. And you know, Terrifier is a series that's really good at that. So I guess it's nothing out of the ordinary, but in this instance, it's doing those practical effects, but also like in a mainstream horror film, which I don't know if we get as much of that. And this one was just having such a good time with it. So I had a blast seeing Evil Dead Rise. I wasn't as high on Renfield as I hoped I would be. It was fun. Nicolas Cage was full on Nicolas Cage's Dracula. Pretty much how you would expect Nicolas Cage to play Dracula. But the real showcase of the movie for me was, thank goodness, Nicholas Holt as Renfield. He's just a very talented young actor, one that I've really enjoy seeing and watching how he kind of carries a performance, kind of carries himself in his roles. So Renfield gets a decent recommendation for me, not anywhere near as high as Evil Dead Rise. Evil Dead Rise is just excellent, and if you like that kind of thing, you should definitely check it out. Renfield is maybe more of a wait until it comes to streaming, which probably will be in a couple of weeks, to be honest with you. The last one that I watched was a streaming premiere, and good God, it was awful. That would be Ghosted, with Chris Evans and Ana de Armas, and man, oh man, that was a mess. Too much going on. Talented actors that didn't really work well together. I don't know, there just wasn't that chemistry. And then there's a good like 5-minute segment of the film where it's just how many cameos can we pack into this movie, which feels more like a stunt than anything that actually helps move the movie along. So yeah, Ghosted, terrible, terrible, terrible movie. The only thing I will say about it, the compliment I have for it, gets undercut by its own production team, because Ana de Armas does really good action choreography. There are some really good fight scenes in this movie. However, those fight scenes are ruined by terrible cinematography and even worse editing. Let's just let people fight. Like, let people fight on screen. There's no need to cover it up. There's no need to cut all around it. Just let people fight. Movies are better when you let people fight. Just kind of show the impact and show them prepare for the... I don't know. I just... Watching these action movies where it's just like chop, 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 you know, cutting all around. The camera's swirling around them while you chop, 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 chop. It's just not good. And this movie suffers from that. So Ghosted sucked. But definitely see Evil Dead Rise, because it is fantastic. That's it. Let's get on with the show, shall we? So this week I am joined by Shane Gerlach. Shane is one of the founding board members of SuperCon here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And man, we have a great conversation talking about life, talking about nerd culture, talking about his featured movie of the week, which when I asked Shane for a movie that he wanted to do, I was a little surprised. I was like, I was thinking that maybe it would be something more like geek culture oriented, more superhero driven, but I was pleasantly surprised with the movie that he selected. So here we go. Go ahead and pop your popcorn, grab a soft drink, kick back, relax, and let's talk about Some Kind of Wonderful. All right, everyone. I am, as always, super excited for this week's episode. This one is a cool one because for me, like, this is somebody that I have followed on social media for a while. We've mutually followed each other on social media for a while, and I have known of his existence for what feels like a long time. Over the last, like, few years, he's been like this mythological figure in Sioux Falls to me, but I've never actually been able to have a sit-down conversation with him to chat and just talk about things. It is time to remedy that. My guest today is one of the founding board members of SuperCon, the Sioux Falls pop culture kind of like geek stratosphere convention, Mr. Shane Gerlach. Shane, how you doing?
I am doing well. Thank you for having me on. I'm here to cleanse any of the bad juju left by Charlie Eccles on past episodes. I'm the exorcist of Charlie Eccles' presence is what I'm here to actually do. So, this is really cool. I just want to thank you for the praise. And, you know, I catch the episodes whenever I can and follow you closely on social media. And this is really cool. This is really cool. And, when you reached out and wanted to, you know, people to talk about movies, I'm really good at the movies I love. And then the things that people want to talk about, I am like, I haven't seen it. So the opportunity to talk about something that I do know really makes, it's pretty cool. It's pretty damn cool. Thank you.
I always think that was kind of like the thing that pushed me forward into changing the podcast, kind of changing the way that I do a podcast, is like, you know, everybody wants to talk about, oh, well, this movie's coming out this week. Let's go see it and talk about it. I'm like, but not everybody can get out to the movie theater and see, you know, Renfield right away, can see, you know, something brand spanking new right away. But to talk to somebody about a movie that means something to them, that they've kind of carried with them for years, like, that's the conversation I want to have. That's what I want to know about. So
I think you're going to, I think just, you know, when we talk to people about something they love, period, mm-hmm. right? We're empowering them to share something special to them, whether that be a hobby, just family, a piece of art, a memory, a movie, whatever it is, you know, I could talk for hours about Daredevil 181. You know, the death of Elektra. I could talk about that issue literally for hours because it's what made me a comic book fan. I was a reader of comics, but that's the one, Frank Miller's 181 Daredevil, made me a fan. And I could break down every panel in that comic almost by memory, you know, and another person doesn't get it. And Frank Miller rightly has his critics may look at it and go, oh, really? But for me, that was special. And, you know, there's people that want to talk about, I'm horrible at this stuff, but somebody wants to talk about Breaking Bad. I've never even watched an episode. I can acknowledge its greatness just by hearing from other people. I just haven't had the time to invest in 82 seasons of Breaking Bad, you know? Yeah. So, but I appreciate someone who loves that. I don't have to partake in something to appreciate someone's love of it, mm-hmm. you know? So yeah, I can respect yeah. that and be excited for you and hear from you. Yeah. That doesn't mean that I, you know, that it sometimes becomes inclusive. And I think that's one of the problems with fandom sometimes mm-hmm. is, well, you haven't read enough or you haven't seen enough, or you didn't catch this little nuance here. So, you know, the worst place in the world is the comment section of any fandom yes. anywhere. It yes. is a cesspool of hatred.
Yeah. And with the like expansion of the internet, where everybody and their dog and grandma can have a social media account, it has just unfortunately become like this den of negativity. And it's so right. like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. So even if somebody recommends a movie or chooses to do a movie that I don't particularly care for, the fact of the matter is it's not about me. I want to talk the movie up. I want to hear the good about it. And I think even with the episodes where I purposely picked out movies that I didn't like, I wanted my guest to be somebody who did, so that they could tell me why this thing is good, you know, and maybe make me see a different perspective of it. That's like, there's right. so much negativity. I don't want that.
Right. Now, please tell me you have not done an episode on the worst movie in the history of man known as Titanic.
Okay. So first off, I have not. Second off, I'm going to disagree with you. I'm going to hard disagree with you and say I love Titanic, but I'm of a certain age. And I remember like that was high school for me. Sure, And you know, every girl loved Leo, which I think maybe should have made it so that I hate Titanic as well. Right. but I don't know. There's something about that movie that's very, very cheesy, but I still am like, I don't know why I fall for these characters for this wild 3 hour, disaster beautiful cinema, love story. Yeah.
Beautiful cinematography, great acting. And it's not the worst film ever made. There's much worse. I just know that my wife will watch this later, and it's a little dig at her. She owns book after book about the Titanic. One of the first trips we took together, I took her to Minneapolis to see pieces that they had brought up from the Titanic. And that was 2 hours of my life I'll never get back. and the multiple viewings, you know, when you're young and in love and you're courting, it's like, no, I would love to watch Titanic mm-hmm. for the 17th time. And I didn't even want to watch it the first time. So that was just a slight dig at my wife, because I know she'll go back and watch it. So
she'll be like, we need to have a conversation.
yeah. She's giving up on that one on me. So
I get that. Shane, I'm gonna we've kind of already started with our chat here, but I'm gonna throw you the question that I tend to start off all of these episodes mm-hmm. with, and that's a very broad, very basic. Shane, who are you? Where did you come from? What is your origin story?
Okay, so that's a great one. I'll tell you so my parents met in the weirdest way. There was, geez, what is it now? It's a Hardee's on 41st Street, where you will occasionally see old cars hang out during the summer. Yeah. When my parents were young, that was known as the Barrel, and that was the hangout for cruising. You cruised Minnesota and Phillips, and that was the hangout. My mom was with a friend in the back of a Jeep Willie, right? And my dad cruised by in a convertible with a friend, and she told her friend that was driving, gun it, and she fell off the back of the Jeep. Came back and took her to the hospital, and that's how they ended up on a first date. So my origin story begins with a faulty pursuit that ended in a hospitalization. So I was born at Fort Carson Army Base in Colorado, where my father was a company clerk because he could type. That was a rarity actually for men.
Yeah.
So he could at that time, so he could type. We moved to my hometown, Flandreau, South Dakota. I graduated high school there. I was a theater geek. I went to college on a theater scholarship to SDSU. Baseball and theater were kind of my thing. Growing up, loved them both, still love them both. And then, I wandered around South Dakota trying to find an education, flunking out of one place, trying a new place, trying to find who I was. And I worked in the bar industry most of my life, the bar and restaurant industry for a lot of my life. My parents had a bar and restaurant and a beauty shop. And I blame them for the loss of all this because let's try the newest color, the newest perm, all these things. So, so I grew up in that industry, so it was comfortable to me. I knew that industry. So I've worked in guest service or customer service for a lot of my life. Met my bride at Ground Round in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I was done with the food industry and I was desperately looking for a job in Sioux Falls. And I actually drove past Ground Round where they had help wanted. And I got down to 41st in Minnesota, which was Shields at the time. And I turned around in the parking lot and went back and said, I'll just screw it. I'll just throw in an application. And I was hired immediately and met her and kind of fell a little bit in lustful young love. And luckily she felt the same. And so that's where we actually met in the food industry. And neither of us work there anymore, but it was a cool place. It's the food industry. If you've ever worked in it, it's just high school. It is high school. I don't care what age you are. The food industry is high school. It is drama. It is puppy love. It is spats. It is all of that stuff writ large. We moved to Yankton, South Dakota, where I worked with kids facilitating youth groups. And I got very, very ill, Andy, in let's see, my son was born in 2018. So 2019, I got very ill, was diagnosed with Graves' disease, and had to have my thyroid removed, had to have a number of different surgeries. And while I was rehabbing and on disability, my wife said, "Hey, idiot, why don't you go back to school and get a counseling degree? You're pretty good at it." So I did. I listened to her as I often do, I went back to school, got a degree, and for the past 9 years, I've been a chemical dependency counselor here in Sioux Falls, working with the felon population transitioning into the community. And I absolutely love my job. It's the dude, it's heartbreaking and amazing at the same time.
Is that a passion that you had kind of before leaping into the higher education aspect of it? Was it something that you were, I don't know, maybe personally affected by, or something that kind of drove you into wanting to counsel people who are on a chemical dependency?
Sure. I'm 29 years clean from amphetamines. In my younger years, if you had it, I'd try
Yeah.
it. You know, so it was the mid 80s to late 80s, and I'm old enough. I'm 54. I'm old enough. The drinking age was 18. You know, so I
Sure.
was going to bars legally at 18. You know, I was fascinated by the lifestyle. I grew up in the lifestyle, poured my first beer on a milk crate, those plastic milk crates at 5 years old. Dad said, "Let's put the little redheaded kid behind the bar. Everybody will love it." And, you know, so I was actually the trained monkey who would pull the tapper and pour beer, you know, at 5 years old. I learned how to read. I would go with my father on Sundays to the bar when he'd clean and restock, and he'd go, "Get me one of these." And soon I realized that says Windsor Canadian, that says Jack Daniels, that says Canadian Club. So I learned how to read from liquor bottles. I learned how to count from playing cards, and I can still recite the words to every bad jukebox song of the 1970s. Dad would bring home the 45s when they'd switch them out. He would bring home the 45s to me, and one of my first gifts I can remember getting was a record player. I had music was very big in my family's life. You know, we had three channels, and on Sundays, as we did family cleaning and, you know, big Sunday dinner or whatever, there was a stack of albums like that thick on the record player that would just drop down. It would be Motown, and then it would be the Doobie Brothers, and then it would be the Rolling Stones, and it would be Kenny Rogers, and just music, so that the combination of then starting to go to see bands in clubs, my age, there was great, I don't even know what to call them, roadhouses still. Lake Bend, Minnesota had one. They were all over. South Yankton, there was one called just across the border into Nebraska. And you'd go and you'd pay to see these great bands, Johnny Holmes, the Litter Band, all these bands. And I became fascinated with that. I was fascinated by the bar lifestyle. I was set up for disaster early because of my fascination with these interesting, I don't want to say unethical, but these interesting, bigger than life characters that I encountered in the music scene and in the bar scene. When you're cooking next to a guy, with tattoos across his knuckles at 16 years old, and these huge tattoos on his forearm, and like, where'd you get those? And you hear these stories about the military and bare knuckle fighting and conquests, I became very fascinated with that lifestyle. And that lifestyle often involves excess, and I was not afraid to partake in that. So I have 29 years clean from amphetamines, and I thought if I could help one person dig out of that hole, it would be cool. And it turned into a career.
For you, is it the conversational aspect of it that really seems to kind of help? Because I'm just kind of your approach to counseling, because I feel like, I don't have any history with addiction. In my family, there was some, but it was when I was, before I was born. So I don't have that experience with it, but I've known addicts and known people who are in recovery and kind of going through it. And I always hear that it's a very difficult, very challenging process, but the thing that kind of helps them is being able to connect with another person and relate with another person who has either the history or at least the empathy to, kind of let them see that they're not alone and that there's not a sense of failure there. It's a constant challenge. For you, is it that conversational aspect of it, the being able to connect with other people that makes it feel so fulfilling, or?
I think that's part of it. I practice what is called unconditional regard. So I'm going to love you, respect you, and accept you, regardless of what you have done, what you may do in the future. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to hold you accountable for that. So for me, it's like, dude, I get it, and knock it the fuck off, right? Like I get what you've done, but that doesn't mean you have to. So I'm very much, I tell my clients all the time, I don't treat any of them any different than I treat people I hang out with. I don't treat them any different than my close friends, my family. It's about accountability. It's about boundaries. It's about the ability to forgive yourself. And I think that's one of the really cool things I see, because so many people with addiction problems are self-medicating, and it's the snake eating its own tail. I use and I feel guilty about it, so I use to kill the guilt. And now I feel, and it's on and on and on, and it's honestly, it's the snake in its own tail. It's a burrow, and until there's nothingness. So, I am at work. I'm known as Pastor Shane of the Church of Fuck, because I don't preach, but I am very verbose with my clients, and I am not afraid to tell them the truth at all. And that's part of accountability. And I'm also a big one to give them hugs or dabs or whatever they're comfortable with, and also praise them, because they're so hard on themselves, because they expect immediate perfection and they forget the progress. And I often quote the great philosopher Dr. Seuss with them, and I tell them, one of my favorite lines from Dr. Seuss is, "You may not be where you want to be, but look at how far you've come." Right. So we're so busy looking, oh, I haven't reached that, I haven't done this, that we forget to look over our shoulder and go, holy shit, look at that. Look at how far I've come. Look at what I have overcome. Look at what I have done physically, mentally, emotionally. Look at the relationships that I thought I had destroyed that I've rebuilt. And we get so focused, and I think it's just societal, we get so focused on what we don't have that we don't appreciate the opportunity that we have right in front of us.
I like, and I think you kind of touched upon this a minute ago too, because it's like, you've created this bond with these people that you're helping, where it's like, you will always be there for them, be there them to offer the support, offer the hugs, but you're not afraid to call them out on their shit too.
Never.
and you said too, that that's kind of how you approach things in life too. Are you like, are you like that as a husband and as a father as well, where it's like, listen, I love you, but you fucked up.
Right. So my wife constantly says, do you have to be so honest? Yeah. So yes, I am. Yes, yeah. I am. I am. And I think part of that is honesty and self-accountability is what helped me pull my own head out of my ass. Right.
Yeah.
It's what brought me success. However that's measured, I feel that I have a very successful life as a survivor, as a father, as a husband, as a son, as a community member. So that accountability and brutal honesty saved my life. So yeah, it's probably who I am, you know.
Yeah.
And I tease him much, but you know, our mutual friend Chuckles and I have had this conversation, and it's honesty, it's empathy, it's accountability, and it's what saves lives.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's important to treat people with a nothing but respect. But I think at the same time too, with that respect, with that empathy, I think there's that need to say, listen, like you said, listen, you screwed up, like, and let's talk about how to make it so this doesn't happen again.
Right.
What changes can you make so that you don't go down this route again? And I respect and admire people who, you know, kind of stick to that, that philosophy, because it's just, I'm trying to think of the way to say this without it like sounding bad, but I think there's a lot of like, we want to blame other people for all of our problems, and we don't always look inward at the stuff that maybe we have had some part in doing.
Absolutely. And so there's three words that hang in my group room at work, and they've traveled with me in every group room I have. And those three words are honesty, humility, vulnerability. So if I am humble enough to admit my shortcomings, or excuse me, honest enough to admit my shortcomings, humble enough to ask for help, and vulnerable to accept that help, then I'm going to be successful. Then I'm going to be an agent of change in my own life, and through that, create a pathway for other people to have that same success, however they want to define that. If that means that I have an Aaron George apartment that I call my own, and I have a great job at McDonald's, there's nothing against either of those things, right?
Right.
But this is successful compared to where I've been. Or if it's, I got my nursing license back and I'm working at a very, whatever it is, or I've reconciled with my children, or my family is now talking to me again. I get to see these successes every single day, multiple times.
Yeah.
It is so refreshing. It's such a killer. And I have heartbreak, and I need to rejuvenate myself, which is, you know, my hobbies, and a good cigar on the deck, or, you know, burying myself in a comic book or a movie, or playing games with my son, or even just watching my son play a game, you know, something that is refreshing to me, that can replenish that battery when it gets a little low, to where I used to use narcotics to do that. Now I use life to do that.
Yeah. you touched upon, you know, the things that you do kind of to unwind when you have those days where, you know, maybe somebody comes in and they've had either a backslide, not maybe not even that they've used, but they're just kind of on that cusp of like, you know, one more bad thing's happen, it could
Right,
push
right.
me over that edge. How would you like, how do you kind of coach them out of it, to kind of help them through like help them through those down moments, and then also so that you don't get so, I guess, wrapped up in their tougher moments, so that
Right.
you don't have your like breaking point as well.
So a lot of what I do, and so he comes to me and says, "Shane, this is, you know, I can't," or, "Oh my God, this is too much, I'm overwhelmed," is what I do is I try to break it down to its simplest terms. And that is the three things that can never be taken from us. That's how I think, how I feel, and how I act. Okay. So this is a little overwhelming. I can't. Okay. But you are. You're sitting here and you're talking to me about it, which means that you're capable of asking for help. We might not be able to fix the problem in this moment, but you're already further than you were before. So let's change our thinking about it. You know, we live in this world of hashtag best day ever, hashtag worst day ever, when the reality is it's someplace in between that. So yes, this is overwhelming. Yes, this is bad, but look at how you're approaching it differently. Okay. And plus, it's okay to feel. It's okay to feel anxious. It's okay to feel grief, anger, sadness, all those things. What we do with that is what defines it. There's no such thing as a good or bad feeling. They simply are. We make them high risk. We make them dangerous by what we do with them. So if I'm overwhelmed and I just say, fuck it, and I quit going to my job and I head to the top hat and, you know, I get a fix and I'm drinking and I waste a paycheck gambling, suddenly feeling overwhelmed is very, very dangerous. But if I come to someone, I say, I need help. What can I do? Okay, well, here's what we're going to do. Let's work on some breathing right here. Let's work on some grounding. What can I see? What can I feel? What can I touch? You know, what's right there for me? Let's work on some imaging. Let's work on, you know, what is a small goal I can reach today? Well, today I cannot use. Today I can go home on an alternate route that doesn't take me through the hood, so I'm not tempted. Today I can go to the falls and just sit quietly. Today I'm going to go to freaking Milky Way and I'm going to get an ice cream cone about that big and I'm going to get it dipped because I don't remember the last time I had an ice cream cone and I freaking deserve it. You wouldn't be surprised how many times, Andy, I just tell them, go get a fucking ice cream cone. Just go get an ice cream cone. Because sometimes that's all it takes. Or go take a nap. You know, that there's this brilliant marketing out there of you're not yourself when you're hungry, right? That is such a brilliant marketing ploy because it's freaking true. If we're not, you know, when was the last time you had something to eat? When was the last time you just sat and did nothing? Yeah, but then Shane, I get stuck up here. Okay, what can we do to distract that? You know, for me, it's the Foo Fighters, it's a comic book, it's a cigar. What is yours? For me, it might even be chopping something and cooking. So you need to find that connection with them. Find somebody that likes to wrench. Get in your fucking garage and wrench, you know. Find somebody who likes to do skin work, you know, draw out a tattoo or see what you can do. If it's spending time with your kids and you're safe here to spend time with your kids, then go and play with your kids. Create a game, play tag, play hide and seek, whatever it is. You know, just do something that takes you out of the moment. And that's all any of us need, Andy, is just that one little to take us out of the moment. Because what happens is we obsess and we spiral. And I say this to my clients all the time, quit picking the scab. Quit picking the scab. Nobody wants to see your ugly open wound. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but nobody wants to see it. But everybody wants to hear the story of how you got the scar. Everybody wants to hear your survivor story. We are a society of second chances and survivor stories. Disney's made $1 billion off of survivor stories and you know the rogue gone good, you know. We love that story. We freaking love that story. Write your own and show us your scar and then tell us the story of that scar. Let it scar over. You know, so just little things like that. And as you can tell, I get a little passionate about it, man. It's such a fulfilling job. It's really cool.
Yeah, I think kind of it seems like, you know, you're a guy connected with your feelings. You know, out, even outside of addiction counseling, it seems to me like you're a pretty good advocate for mental health counseling, and especially male mental health. I think that's one of those things that I don't I think more attention is getting paid towards male mental health. You know, I think that's something that nowadays we're kind of taking stock in. But it feels like there was a time where it was just you're a man, suck it up, move along.
Right.
You don't always
We
have to.
were taught that. Well, we were taught that. And generationally, we've been taught that. And we live in the Midwest where, you know, put your nose down and do the work and stay in your lane, right? Where, you know, we still whisper the word, did you hear Dolores ask? You know, we whisper it. We won't even say it aloud. We'll quietly put our change in a jar. You know, when we're at the, or we'll round up. I guess now there's not so much change. We just round up. We won't be proactive. We won't talk about it. I'll donate something for a silent auction. I'll bring you a goddamn casserole, but let's not talk about it because, you know, let me mow your lawn for you though. I got that for you. You're busy. Things are going on. You know, and that's just been generational. I think that, you know, that Northern European, Scandinavian, German, Midwest, generational farmers, hard workers, this is what we do, has been driven into us. And also, you know, the male stereotype, you're the fixer, you're the hunter, you're the gatherer, you don't show your wounds, you cover your damn wounds up, rub some butter on it, and get back out there. Yeah, you know, and it's killing us. It's killing us at younger and younger ages through heart attacks. It's driven divorce rates. It's alienated families. It's alienated children. It has caused alcoholics, drug addicts, workaholics, sexaholics, gambling addicts. It has caused detachment. It has caused more pain out of just rub some dirt on it and just power through than saying, this sucks, and I need somebody to talk to. And having again that vulnerability, and see, we somewhere along the line, vulnerability got this really, really bad rap as a word that if you're vulnerable, you're a victim. If you're vulnerable enough to ask for help, you're the strongest person I know. Because to suffer alone is, it's an early death. It's a death sentence. Even if it's not a physical death, it is an emotional and mental death sentence. You become so detached. You know, think about the number of kids who came home and dad grunted, ate supper, sat in his chair with the remote, and never talked. Hey, dad, how's your day? Fine. In my world, what fine means is fucked up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. That's what fine means. And fine, fine. Go help your mother. You know, it's we didn't talk about it. No matter how much they were hurting inside, no matter how much they were behind on bills at the business or worried about the crop was going to fail or worried about they were failing as a father, they didn't talk about it. You know, and they, you know, maybe they sat in silence over a Territon 100 cigarette or a, you know, a Winston or a Camel, you know, went out to the garage to check on things, you know. But they certainly didn't let anyone see it. And I'm really happy to see that generationally that is losing its hold. I think that, you know, as a Gen Xer, we were okay at it. We started, but I think the, you know, millennials and Gen Z have really embraced communication, communicating their feelings. And having empathetic understanding is that's one of the cool things. That's one of the cool things about social media. It's a cesspool sometimes, but being able to watch people empower other people. If you don't follow Tyler Roney on social media, by the way, follow him because he's such an advocate for exactly what we're talking about here. Yeah, it's awesome. And to see
I was gonna
public
ask.
figures. Yeah, just, yeah.
Who are outspoken about it. I was gonna ask, do you think that there was a moment where society said enough is enough and that we want to, connect with these feelings, not be ashamed of these feelings? Or do you think it was more just a like a generational shift? Like maybe the younger generation saw how their parents were dealing with things and they're like, I don't want that. I want something different. Like I'm just more like what your opinion is of where that shift kind of happened.
I think it's twofold. I think that that too many of us saw the disconnect, and I loved my father, but man, he could be an asshole. And the feeling I saw was when I saw an emotion from him, it was anger, right? So that was the big emotion. Not that he was angry all the time, but that's when I knew he was being emotional when he was angry. He would laugh and stuff all the time, but anger. I'm going to yell at you. So that was the emotion that I kind of knew. So I think it's generational, but I'm going to throw something at you. Robert Downey Jr. Robert Downey Jr. Publicly falling and then publicly admitting it and publicly speaking about it yet to this day. I think if I had to pick a moment culturally, I can't think of a better one than that, because it wasn't Hendrix dying, it wasn't Janis dying, it wasn't Cobain dying, it wasn't Cornell dying, it wasn't, and all these things happened, right? But conversation started happening around Robert Downey Jr. about not only addiction, but why addiction? Because we'd say, oh, look, yay, the recovered addict. Yay, let's write a movie about him, right? Let's write a story about him. Oh, Betty Ford, yay, and Dr. Drew on Celebrity Rehab, yay, Courtney Love's clean for a day. But Robert Downey Jr. was different in that he didn't let you forget how lucky he is. He didn't let you forget the people that helped him. He didn't let you forget that it's okay as a man to talk about your feelings and admit your failings. And that's been rare. Knowing that someone fucked up hasn't been rare. Someone publicly acknowledging it and continuing to talk about it and have that in their conversations has been very rare for people in power. Our current president's very public grieving and talking about his son's addictions is beautiful. Beautiful, especially for a man of that generation. That's rare. So I think that there's a cultural shift and a generational shift.
And I think that both things are kind of hand in hand, where it's just like just watching the transition. And I think you're right. I think the spectacle of media coverage for Robert Downey Jr. going through the worst of his addiction in the public eye, and then still continuing that coverage, and then celebrating how he has transitioned out of it and letting him tell his story that, listen, this is an everyday thing. I'm not miraculously cured. I'm still fighting. And I think that's great. I'm going to change gears for a second, and we're going to talk about really fun stuff.
Okay, cool. I want to double back on one thing here quick before we move on. You said something really important, and that's that they're letting him tell his story. And I think that's important for any storyteller in any genre, in any part of our lives, is that when we allow the storyteller to tell the story rather than, I want to tell your story. And what Robert Downey Jr. has done is he's owned his recovery story. And that's what's very empowering and very cool for other people to see, is that I'm going to tell the tale. So great insight there, Andy. That's I think you were spot on there, man.
I just think I he's been I remember when all of that was in the media, like when all of the struggles were just so public and they were everywhere. Every news show was covering how this actor has fallen from grace. And then it's just been to be able to watch the comeback, the fight, the struggle, the recovery has just been like he is in charge of his own narrative. And like it's been a very encouraging, very inspirational thing. But I think too, the fact that he says it's not always easy is even more inspirational, because it's like, we're all going to have to deal with shit along the way.
Absolutely.
And it's not all sunshine and roses. Like, we're going to have to step through piles of feces to get to the end of our, you know, the end of our story. So, moving on to fun stuff. We'll talk about something very fun. When did you embrace your love of kind of pop culture, genre entertainment? Like, when was this something? Because this is something that is huge for you. I think that's kind of, that's even an understatement to say that this is something that you love and adore. But is it something that you embraced very early on in your life? Or
so, for as long as I can remember, I always had comic books. Always. My mother and father's had a beauty shop, and they had the bar. The beauty shop was six doors down from the Rexall drugstore that had a huge comic and magazine rack. And dad would pick them up, and he'd, you know, hand them to me. I was reading at a fourth grade level at kindergarten. I was reading at a senior in high school level as a fourth grader. And that's because I had to figure out what words like adamantium and Mjolnir meant. And the Thor comic books got me into mythology. And the Captain America comics got me interested in history. And, you know, all these different things happened because of comic books. I didn't even know what vigilante meant, but I learned how to read it. And then I learned what it meant. So they've always been there. And then something pretty fantastic happened in my life. So all that was really cool. My grandma in Del Rapids, I go, and I had two male cousins just older than me, one 2 years, one 4 years. And then my little sister, and she had a box. You'd open up this cupboard down below, and there was a box you could pull out full of comic books. Scrooge McDuck, The Flash, you name it. Richie Rich, Archie. So it's just all these comics, because she would just pick them up and throw them in this box. And God, I wish I had that box. Who knows where that was.
Right?
but this magic thing happened. The Crystal Theater in Flanders, South Dakota, every Christmas, they would have a children's Christmas movie. And I don't even remember how old I was. This is before Star Wars, so before I was nine. The free movie they showed us was King Kong versus Godzilla. And holy crap, was that cool. and then my babysitter, because my parents owned two businesses, they were gone a lot, I had it. My babysitter was the projectionist for the Crystal Theater. So I got to see some really cool movies from up in the balcony, which was condemned and you weren't allowed to sit in. But I got to sit up there and, you know, Star Wars, Alien, I mean, movies that I shouldn't have been seeing for sure. Like Alien, which scared the shit out of me. but there was also some really, really great cheesy TV at the time that I fell in love with. And Space 1999 was just a huge, my God, I love that show. And the Saturday morning cartoons, Thundar the Barbarian, the Super Friends. So this babysitter had David Jeske. He had us all day Saturday. And there were three friends that all lived within shouting distance. My friend David Kringen lived one house away. My friend Kelly Duncan lived three houses away around the corner. And we were inseparable. And there was this junkyard half a block away. And David Jeske, our babysitter, created the Nautilus for us out of one car. And, you know, and I was Captain Nemo, or, you know, where we'd take turns. And he created the Starship Enterprise for us. When I mean created, he took boards and made the car look like the Starship Enterprise with the tubes on the side. And he took his skill saw, and he made us all phasers, and he made us all, we had one tricorder, and we all had communicators. And so I had this babysitter who would just, dude, he was a nerd. And so he was like, I get to help raise little nerds. How cool is that? So all of this culminated, and you know, the magic of the late 70s and early 80s, was great comic books. Well, in retrospect, they were really cheesy, not great comic books, but they
Sure.
were fun comic books. They were great movies, great sci-fi TV, and then A Babysitter and Friends, who, oh, geez, the lost hours. When my mother went to sell her house, in the closet of my childhood bedroom is a crude drawing in red marker of the Starship Enterprise, and it says a Star Trek fan club. We just had our own little chapter of the three of us, and we'd have our secret meetings in that big old closet that was connected to my bedroom. So all those things kind of, the Star Trek reruns, like I said, Space 1999, Buck Rogers, the Flash Gordon movie, Aliens, on and on. The horrible first Star Trek movie that my father took me to and fell asleep in. And then my dad started bringing me home Conan, the Conan books.
Yeah.
The Robert E. Howard Conan books, which I loved. And then he bought me, one Valentine's, he got me The Gunslinger, Stephen
Okay.
King's The Gunslinger. It was done then. It was done.
Yeah, yeah.
So all these, I had people, I think I had people that were like, okay, well, if this is what he loves, then let's encourage that. My grandmother, who knew nothing about it, bought me the, like for Christmas, birthday, and the next Christmas, I got the Dungeon Master's Guidebook, the Monster Guidebook, and the Player's Guidebook for Dungeons and Dragons. She knew nothing about
Yeah.
it, but she knew her grandson loved it. So
Yeah.
let's get him this. I can just see, I can see this, 77-year-old lady in Doubleday Books or B. Dalton Booksellers. Do you have the Dungeons and Dragons stuff?
Right.
So I had people who encouraged my love of this, and I try to do the same for my son. And for I'm very generous about, here, read this, try this, have you watched this? I'm trying to encourage people to get a footprint into fandom, into pop culture. So.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like, and maybe this was just me, and it was never my family. My family never discouraged it, but it feels like there was always this wave of like culture that was like, no, nerd stuff is stupid. Like, don't who only nerds like comic books and things like that. But there's always been this kind of like supportive system of people who either get it or at least like a person enough to encourage that they get it. Because my mom was always a person who was like, oh, well, if there's a comic book store, like we might as well go and look around. If there's, if they have them at the grocery store, go ahead and pick up a comic book. It was never frowned upon. Same thing with movies. That's a whole different avenue of like enjoyment. My whole family was movie into movies for a very, very long time. But with comic books, they were just, it was almost like, I don't know, almost as normal as a paperback book in my family because it was so encouraged to just be like, if you like this, enjoy it, read it, because hey, you're reading something that, and that's all that mattered. Was it helpful to kind of have that encouraging system to just embrace the things that you liked?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely it was.
Yeah.
And growing up in a town of 2200 in Flanders, South Dakota, it was so I don't know that there was a hard delineation between the jocks and the nerds and the theater, because the captain of the football team was right next to me on stage. I was Marion Sam and he was little Abner. I was Schroeder and he was Charlie Brown, the
Yeah.
head of the cheerleaders. So because there was, I think I had that unique perspective that, or opportunity, I wanted to say perspective, I had that unique opportunity where everybody had to fill a role. If you're going to do a musical, the jocks got to be in the musical, right? They
Yeah.
can't just be the seven theater nerds. If you're going to have a debate team or a speech team, everybody has to be in it. If we were going to fill the table to play a Dungeons and Dragons game, then I had to have our first baseman and I had to have, the outcast kid. And, so we all did things. And then we'd all go and play a game of pickup basketball or wiffle ball or, kill the carrier football or whatever as well.
Yeah.
So I think that we just, golly, I'm making it sound almost, I really, rose
Idyllic.
tinted glass. Yeah, right. And
Yeah.
dude, we still argued over the over stupid stuff. My friends Steve and David and I got into a physical altercation over the physical altercation in my house. All three of us fighting on the floor, me against two of them, over the musical genius of Prince, who I was advocating for, versus ZZ Top, who they were advocating for. I'm like,
Oh.
are you kidding me here? I said, Prince plays every instrument, writes everything, and it got physical. So we had fights
Yeah.
over, we still, and girls and guys and, whatever. It still was teenage. It still was angsty. It still was, you still, everybody, she's the popular one. She's the nerdy one. He's the jock. That's the burner, whatever. Everybody had a role, but they were really blinded and blended. Right, because the popular girl secretly likes The Cure, but she's listening to Night Ranger because all of her friends are, right? So, and the jock didn't want anybody to know that he was a paladin, in my Dungeons and Dragons group, but he was, so
Star quarterback is a bard.
Yeah, let me show up with my little harp. I'll be fine. My
Right.
lute, my lute.
Oh, that's fun. What was I going to ask? I had a question that came up, and then my brain was just like, nah, never mind. Oh no, I was going to say in team Shane versus your two friends there, I would have been on team Shane with the Prince conversation because listen, Prince, musical genius, completely across the board. I'm way more of a Prince fan than I ever have been a ZZ Top fan. In fact, my favorite ZZ Top song might be the one from Back to the Future 3. That's how far removed I am from
Out,
ZZ
out.
Top fandom.
And it was the phrase musical genius that where the first punch was thrown. I said Prince the musical genius, and they're like, and again, then and time capsule. Words have, well, words are awful, and but you fag, I mean, that was thrown out. And then, now we're punching, now we're wrestling. Now I'm somehow ended up in a body scissors from one while I'm elbowing the other. And it was WWE in my parents' living room. It was awesome.
I want to I'm gonna come back to wrestling in a minute here, but I'm glad that you that's kind of a precursor to one question I have later down the road here. So with your kind of like love and adoration of all things like nerd geek culture, where did the desire for SuperCon, your involvement with SuperCon, when did that all kind of come to fruition for you to kind of like do something with this love?
I can tell you exactly when it happened. I went to FableCon in Rochester, Minnesota, which was Bill Willingham's convention he had around his beautiful. I just got done rereading all the volumes yesterday. I reread them. I do this about every year, every other year. And so I went to FableCon in Rochester, Minnesota, and it was the best experience, convention fan experience I'd ever been to. I hadn't been to a ton, but my God, it was awesome. And I came home to Yankton, South Dakota, and I'm like, I need to do this. I need to do this here. And so I talked to a few people, and I was trying to get a financial backer, and I wanted to create just a small Saturday-only convention called Nerd Prom, which would end with the crowning of the nerd king and queen and have a dance at night, have, just a one-day convention of gaming and comic books, some vendors, and then end with a dance. And we planned it and we were working on it. We even had a location. We had all these things. And what ended it was my banker was like, we need to sign this big star. This person needs to come. And I kept saying, no, you don't. South Dakota hasn't had a convention like this for years. If we just throw it, they're going to come and we'll expand. And then we can get, Daryl Dixon. Is who he wanted. He wanted well, I can't think of his name that plays Daryl Dixon on The Walking Dead.
Oh, sure.
That's that's who he wanted. And I'm like, we know because we'll have to charge so much to make up for that. So that's what ended it. Fast forward, and my friend Brian Brockmeyer is like on Facebook, and he's like, if I throw a comic book convention, will you come? And that's where the idea for Supercon came. And he came up with this beautiful name of Supercon. It's a great name, man. It is a great name. And he will argue this to his grave, but I still have the text. I have saved it. And I sent, when I saw the branding, I saw him talking about it. I sent him a text and I said, Brian, we need to talk about Supercon. Now, Brian will say he invited me, that the genius of Brian Brockmeyer was like, I need to bring this person who can talk and promote. I need to bring this guy on. No, Brian, I forced my way into your life. And I wanted it. It wasn't happening. Brian wanted it and it began to happen. And between the two of us and Joe and Danny and Cassie and Brandon and Josh, that first group of us, we had no idea what we were doing. And we created a convention. Brian put the three event rooms in the basement of the Best Western on his credit card. I put all the guest rooms on my credit card. And we needed 1,200 people to break even. So we printed out 1,200 lanyards because then we'd know if we broke even. The lanyards were gone by 2 o'clock on Saturday, and we had a day and a half to go yet. And
Nice.
we had to go and get like the tear bands that you get at like a beer garden or a street dance. We had to send somebody to the dollar store to get those, so we could keep letting people in. So and then it's just growing from there. And I'm the last surviving founding board member. No, I mean, somewhere along the line, I became known as Super Shane. Derek, my son, is so amazed. Like, we'll go someplace and be like, blah, 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 and they'll be talking to me. I'm like, how do you know that? I'm like, I don't know. And I love y'all. I love all of you. But I might not recognize you out of your cosplay. I also might not recognize you because 7,100 people came through the door last year. And y'all only have to remember my name and face. It's impossible to re for me to remember 7,100 of y'all. So, but yeah, it's become this thing, man. And it's cool, and it has this much to do with me, this much. I just have become the public face somehow. But it is a we have 22 dedicated staff members that work their butts off for no pay, a board of three, a management team of seven. To create this monster now that we have that went from a hotel basement to a state-of-the-art convention center and all the facility. We added the arena this year. So we're the convention center, all the breakout rooms, and the arena. So yeah, it's a monster. It's a freaking monster.
It's so wild because I was a visitor to the first year of SuperCon. One SuperCon idol. Don't wanna brag, but I will brag. My performance of Sweet Transvestite from the Rocky Horror Picture
Yes.
Show
Yes. Yeah.
knocked them
Oh
there.
my God. Yes. Oh my God. That's outstanding.
That
Yes.
was me. But
That
loved it. But
is so awesome.
it was this you could tell that it was something that was put together by people who just wanted to like have a convention, have something like this for us in this community. And watching it grow as an outsider has been really incredible to just see the growth, the amount of people that show up, the names of people that arrive as guests. How is it for you, kind of being on the inside, to watch how this thing has expanded? Outside of it being scary, and probably intimidating, how does it feel just to watch like the growth of this whole thing?
Humbling, you know. So people ask me all the time because this is the first year that I have not booked guests. Melissa Prostrello is booking the guests now. Melissa worked with me as a guest handler for years, and I just needed to take some of the stuff off my plate. I can't do it. I realized that it's gotten too big now where I can't do like three different roles. So I'm the convention director and I'm the staff director now. So people say, how did you get such and such? I asked. I just asked. And people are like, well, that's not a reptile. It can't be true. Well, why can't it be true? Why? Because that's what I did. And those early guests, Andy, I never went through an agent. I didn't go through an agent until personally. Now, the year that I was gone with Derek for treatment, Tyson and Charlie used agents, which is fine, is perfect. I didn't use an agent, didn't talk to an agent until last year for Bobby Singer. I've just on Twitter, on Facebook, by researching and finding an email. And now, what is really cool is the last few years, I have agents contacting me saying, can my client come to your convention? Like, what? Oh, yes. Yes, they can. When I've got Duncan McLeod of the Clam McLeods agent contacting us to ask if he can come to freaking SuperCon, yes, you can. You absolutely you can, you gorgeous human being. I would love to have you at Sioux Falls. But watching it grow, it's I didn't think we'd hit the convention center tier year five. That was the internal growth that we so to outgrow the entirety of the Best Western in 2 years and have it necessitated that we move into the convention center by year three. So yeah, we're ahead of schedule. And that has very little to do with us. It has everything to do with the support of the community. We just had a Experience Sioux Falls do an economic impact statement on us. So all tourism departments have this program that they run through, and they show the economic impact that you have. SuperCon brings in $1.3 million to Sioux Falls over a 3-day weekend. Andy, $1.3 million we bring in: hotels, gas, food.
Like you're grossing as much as an independent film sometimes.
It's ridiculous. We don't see that. I mean, what's crazy is, and I just signed, and we'll have a press release out soon. I just signed another sponsor today. A good one, a really good one that I'm just so happy they jumped on with us because they're also part of the nerd culture of Sioux Falls. Teaser, be watching the Facebook page. The hardest part of this is giving away the money at the end of the year and then going and begging for more. That's so hard, and it's the right thing to do because we just were at JY6 presenting a check for childhood cancer research. We were just at Reach Literacy presenting a check for adult literacy needs. And this year, SuperCon is going to honor our commitment to those two, and we're going to give $5,000 to Make-A-Wish to make a kid's wish come true. So that's the easy way would it be to like, oh, this is my job now. I run a convention, and the board's going to pay me X amount of dollars. I get $0 and 0 cents for this. And I work a job 45 hours, and I come home and I probably put 35 hours in a SuperCon willingly and lovingly, because I have this great fear of failing the community we've created, and I'm not going to do it. Not on my watch. Not on my watch, and not on the board's watch, and not on the committed staff that we have. I mean, we're just not going to, through will and grit, we're going to every year put on a 3-day party where everybody can be accepted. This is so funny. This year we're going to have our third craft beer. So craft beer nerds, we're going to have food trucks again this year, movies, wrestling, burlesque, comic books, magic, science. We provide, what's really cool is we provide a space for 100 local artisans and small business owners to see 7,100 people looking at their product. You tell me where in Sioux Falls you're going to have 7,100 people walk through your door and see your product, or 7,100 people in 3 days look at your Etsy page. It's not going to happen. But last year, 7,100 people got to look at people's products and buy
Oh,
their
it's so
goods.
cool.
Yeah,
It's
that's
so
pretty
cool.
freaking cool. I mean,
It's
that's part of
been
it. Part of it that people don't think about it. They're like, oh, cool guest. And oh, I got this drawn. 75 to 100. And this year, Randy said we're going to have 100 because of the expansion, 100 vendors. 100 vendors getting that exposure.
Yeah. That exposure is so important. Like it helps your business grow, your presence grow. Like if you're an artist, it gets your work out in front of all of those people. Like it's so awesome for that opportunity to be there for these people in Sioux Falls who, for a lot of them, it's just a thing that started as a hobby that has kind of grown into like, I have a talent. I want to embrace that talent. I want to share that talent with other people. And now here I am. I get to be out there in front of, 7,100 people who get to see, my drawings.
With disposable income. Yeah, people save money the whole time, And here's a little insider thing. I don't get cosplay. I throw the biggest cosplay competition in a three-state area. I don't get it. I love it. I love looking at it. I adore all the cosplayers. I grew up in a state where cosplay is as camo in a deer stand. So, dude, I am so impressed by these people. I am, it's mind blowing the talent, mind blowing. And I love them. And if you'd have told me that cosplay was going to be our biggest draw of the weekend, I no. Everybody's going to line up to see Bill Willingham. Everybody's going to line up to see Phil Hester. Everybody's going to line up to see the biggest draw of the weekend consistently. And burlesque and wrestling have caught up. They're real close. But is cosplay? It fills standing room only, the biggest room that we have at the convention center. And man, you want to talk about, and I've had mothers come up to me and say, my child felt accepted. I had a young man, we were at Pride 2 years ago, and this young man comes up and gives me a hug at our booth at Pride. And I'm like, hey, no idea who he is, right? And he starts explaining who he is. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. And he says, because of SuperCon's cosplay competition, I had the courage to tell my father I'm going to go to fashion school instead of engineering school.
That's so awesome. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
It's
So if we do nothing else right, we did that.
incredible how this world of I always feel like it's undercutting what it is, but calling it geek culture, how this world brings so many people together with a sense of acceptance and feeling like your home can open you up to feel more comfortable in, your outside world. And I love that. I just think that's such a great thing. What else did I want to ask you about SuperCon? I get so engrossed in what you're saying that I have a question that pops up and then I'm like, oh, it's gone. It's completely left me. It's
That's
completely
okay.
disappeared.
That's okay.
I don't know. I'll move on then to what my next topic. I had two other subjects I wanted to talk about quickly before we dive into our movie. I don't know how much you want to talk about this, but I always want to ask, how's Derek doing? If you do you
Yeah,
want to share
no,
anything with
thank you.
Derek?
Thank you. Yeah, so thank you. For those who don't know, fight Derek fight on my arm there. It's hard to see, but anyway, at 10 years old, my now 15-year-old was diagnosed with stage 4 medulloblastoma brain cancer. Not a great survival rate. His favorite wrestler is Kevin Owens, and our friend Charlie made this logo, Fight Derek Fight, stolen from Fight Kevin Fight, Fight Owens Fight. Charlie made that for us. It was all over Facebook. It was everywhere. And so we went through a year of, well, a year and a half of radiation and chemo, and between Rochester at the Mayo Clinic and Sioux Falls at the Children's Castle. And he came through the treatments great. We are now 3 years. So right before the pandemic hit, we went to Disney World to celebrate the end of his treatment. So yeah, so we're at just about 3 years post treatment, and every single scan has come back clean. He had no recurrence of the cancer. Little things, little things like neuropathy in the feet. So we go, and play at the Field House once a month with PT Dan. He's one of the most amazing people, and you should totally try to get as a guest. He's a huge geek culture fan and one of the
Awesome.
kindest, most beautiful humans in the world. So we get to go and do that. You know, they're monitoring growth patterns. We just found out he's going to tap out at about 5'9" because the radiation on his spine shrunk. So, like, I have my son is alive. Like, I don't care if he's 5'9" or 6'9", my son's alive, right? So he's only going to grow like projected, you know, like an inch and a half more. He's still going to be like 3 inches taller than Charlie Eccles, so that's cool. You know, so yeah. So I mean, I don't, you know, little things like that. So they're watching growth, they're watching hormones. Cognitively, they were worried because of where it was located. He's got over a 4.0 grade point average, so I don't think that hurt him at all. So yeah, no, he's awesome. He's a typical 15-year-old, at times completely lovey, at times completely goofy, and at times completely hormonal boy, you know. So yeah, just completely blessed. Thank you so much for asking. It's yeah, I appreciate it. We've been very public, and that was a choice. We were very public from the start. We okayed it with Derek. We said there's an opportunity here. There's an opportunity here to normalize pain, to normalize grief, to normalize joy, to normalize community. So it was a conscious effort from Danelle and I, to publicly wage this battle on childhood cancer, and with Derek's permission, he's got his mother's more reserved personality. So he doesn't want to be the face and out there. He has a few times where he's been comfortable doing it, like at the Make-A-Wish banquet and different things. He's done a few news interviews and killed it. He doesn't think he's a public speaker, but he is. But he's like, let's do this thing. And my 15-year-old son has, you know, like in his phone, you know, is constantly texting Kevin Owens, you know, talks to, you know, Gleyber Torres, the second baseman of the freaking New York Yankees, you know, as Willie Randolph in his, you know, I mean, it's stupid. He has a sketchbook, actually 3 volumes of sketchbook. People send him sketches, you know, of art that, you know, you go to a convention, you pay $1,000 for these custom pieces that people sent him because he found comfort in it. So I started a hashtag sketches for Derek on Twitter, and pieces rolled in from creators all over, from Judd Winnick to people sent from Paris. Jason Aaron sent signed books. I mean, on and on. He got showered with this stuff, and it was, like I say, it was a public, it wasn't to get him things. I want to make that clear. It was just a public, it was a public, it was a public battle, and we wanted to fight it publicly.
It's being able to see the family at the center of it kind of puts a face on the illness. And so it kind of, I feel like it gives people a chance to, this is, I don't know if this is a cynical view of it or what, but I feel like I don't think it's cynical. For me, it's hopeful. It feels optimistic. It feels a sense of community, but it gives people a chance to kind of do something, to show their support for one family when they can't necessarily support every single family that's going through it. At least they can kind of contribute, help try and change the spirits of one family that's going through it. And I think that's something that makes the people contributing feel better, but I also think it enhances that sense of connection, because I do feel like we're all so connected because of the internet, but we're also more isolated because of the internet.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, because I can find my clan, my tribe, my people right here, and I don't have to interact with those. So this was, you know, a kid getting sick is universal. And what's really cool is we've had, because of our public, you know, because of our desire to be public with it, we've had so many other families reach out to us that, you know, their child got diagnosed after Derek, and we've been able to help them. Like, here's a fundraiser, here's a charitable organization, here's the doctors we consulted, you know. So just being able to go hand in hand with some of these other families has been pretty cool too.
Yeah, creating that kind of network is just, I can't even imagine how helpful having those resources and for other people who are going at it. You know, when you get that news, I can imagine it's just this shock of like, what the hell am I going to do? Like, what are we going to do? And having a network of people that have gone through it to kind of talk to is probably one of the most invaluable resources that you
It
can have.
was for us. Rob Kiesacker immediately reached out from Voices Against Cancer and from the 501st. Rob Kiesacker reached out immediately to us and said, because they had gone through it. They had gone through it with their boy Ian. And Rob reached out and said, listen, and the best advice he gave me was, don't worry about the bills. They're going to be there at the end. Take care of your family. They're not going to not provide you service. Just don't worry about the bills. Just worry about your family. And to have that, he leaned over me in full Death Star regalia as the 501st came to meet Derek at the children's hospital and leaned over and said that to me in my ear. And I was like, oh my God, I needed to hear that right now. Because, I'm sitting there watching the hospital bills. And then and I sold every body part. I just sold everything I have, whatever. And that was with insurance. It was still, boom, 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 racking up. But for him to say that at that moment, because he knew what I was going through, because he'd sat there in that same castle going through it. Yeah. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Weird community to be a part of, but a pretty cool community to be a part of.
Most definitely. I feel like this is one of those groups where or one of those communities that everybody really looks out for each other
Yeah,
once you
for
kind of form
sure.
that bond all over like an allegiance over a certain thing. And I think that's so cool. My last little bit before we dive into the movie is Shane, I know you're a wrestling fan, so I'm going to ask you the hardest wrestling question that I can think of. You're a wrestling fan from way back, so I gotta know, what is your go-to match? Like when people say, what's your favorite match you've ever seen, or like favorite era, like what's your wrestling? What is your moment in professional wrestling?
So I'm going to give you three, okay? Because I know this answer. So I grew up on Georgia Championship Wrestling on WTBS from 5:05 to 7:05 on Saturdays, and from 5:05 to 6:05 on Sundays with Gordon Soley as the voice. And so my original match, the match that made me was such a huge fan was Tommy Wildfire Rich against Buzz Sawyer in a cage at the Omni in Atlanta. Blood match. It was these two had it was a hot feud. It wasn't the feud. It wasn't even for a belt because Flair had the belt. Dusty had the belt. He had the Road Warriors were the tag champs, or the Armstrongs, Bullet Bob and his boy Brad. See, it wasn't even about the belts. It's just about these two guys who freaking hated each other, and they played off each other. Tommy Rich, the long blonde hair and the fiery temper, and Buzz Sawyer with his hairy torso, and he'd have been perfect for Wolverine, by the way, and just mean pile drive you on cement, so that was the first one that really made me, really made me. And then I stepped away from wrestling for a while. Other things got in the way, and I hated the cartoon WWE. I mean, I hated cartoon WWE. And they literally made a cartoon of it because I hated it. So I kind of stepped away. And then the match that brought me back was actually shown at my dad's bar. He used to have these big satellites to get things in, and he had it on the projection TV. By the way, we were really cutting edge satellite dish and projection TV. Was the Jimmy Snuka, I love you, off the cage. Brought me back in. And then my favorite match though of all time is Flair Steamboat 3, the 1 hour match. They had three, well, they had a number of matches, but that year they had three of them in a row, and the Chicago one, Steamboat and Flair, is my all-time favorite match. Ric Flair is my all-time favorite wrestler. He's not my all-time favorite human because he kind of sucks as a human. I wanted to throw things at the TV when I watched the most recent documentary. By the way, wrestling and non-wrestling fans, If you've never watched the WCCW story, the Von Erichs and the Dallas, and you, whoo, yeah, like, and I grew up reading about them, and because we didn't have cable, you know, until we did. But I read all these wrestling fanzines and stuff, and you know, you had wrestling was so regionalized that we didn't get world class wrestling from the Sportatorium in Dallas, Texas. But I read about them, and every once in a while, one of the Von Erichs would come into Georgia. Then the Freebirds came into Georgia, and I'd read about these guys and the tragedy of the Von Erich family. And I think they're making a movie
They
about the
are.
Von Erichs. And Zac Efron's playing what is Zac Efron playing Carrie?
I think he's playing Carrie Von Erich.
You want to talk about a tragic story? And that. That Blu-ray, that DVD, that series, I guess you can probably get it on the WWE Network now or Peacock, is fantastic. That is just the world class championship wrestling story is fantastic.
The actor from the TV show The Bear is also in it, and he's playing Kevin Von Erich. Oof,
Kevin,
I don't remember.
yep.
But gosh, I'm so excited for that. MJF is supposed to have a role in that movie as
Oh,
well, so
Jesus. Jesus. He's he
probably
never breaks
nothing.
character. He never breaks
He's
character.
probably just a villain.
He would be perfect as Piper. He would be perfect as
Oh
Piper.
man, that'd be great.
Or he would be perfect as Hot Rod.
I realize, Shane, that I could probably talk to you for hours on end, not just about wrestling, but about everything, just because I'm really enjoying this conversation. But I have to move on to our featured movie of the week. And this is going to be another complete shifting of the gears from wrestling. We're going to dive into some 1980s John Hughes with the romantic comedy, romantic dramedy, I guess. I don't
Sure,
know.
sure, sure.
Some Kind of Wonderful.
I wish you guys could experience the humiliation of having the weirdest guy in a huge school be a blood relative.
Some Kind of Wonderful is funny and involving with a lot of charm, says the New York Times.
That's what my girlfriend would look like without skin.
And People magazine says it's comic and romantic, thoroughly winning.
You should consider whether or not you feel you can deliver a kiss that kills.
Some Kind of Wonderful.
So Shane, the first question I'll ask you right out the gate is, in your own words, what is Some Kind of Wonderful all about?
Some Kind of Wonderful is this beautiful examination of 1980s socioeconomic culture. The right side of the tracks and the wrong side of the tracks, and desire for those who grew up with nothing to have something. That's the view I see in the movie. I think it's a beautiful cultural commentary of that time. I think that Hughes did that with, I think the only movie that Hughes did that better with was 16 Candles. I think that that was very realistic. I think this stands up there with the realistic view of the socioeconomic lines that are drawn and how that trickles down to kids and how they are cast in the role, even if they're not that. You know, my father's a greasy mechanic, so that's all I can be. And this desire to break out of that social caste. That's what I see. What's the movie about? It's about a really horny dude who wants the hot chick and his best friend who is all kind of pissed off at him for wanting the hot chick and not her.
I
And
think both.
it's go ahead, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, I think both of those are completely accurate.
Yeah, it's so, and it's also, and you might, I don't know if you caught this or not when you watch it, it's also a tribute to the Rolling Stones.
Because
Steve Watts
Miss Amanda Jones.
is a wonderful song by the Stones, under unheralded song by the Stones, but the lead character's name is Keith, and the antagonist's name is Watts. Keith Richards and Charlie Watts. So it's this beautiful tribute to the Stones too. And you want to talk about blue collar, You know, I mean, at that time, the Stones were seen as blue collar, and the Beatles were seen as the elite. You know, even though they were all poor working kids, but yeah, the blue, you know, the preppies and the yuppies were drawn to the Beatles and the cuteness, and the burners and blue collar and the working class were drawn to the Stones. So that's such a great analogy. Hughes just layer after layer, man. Onion after onion. People like, the dude just wrote teen dramedies. Bullshit, man. He wrote comments on society and culture.
Yeah, through a teen viewpoint. Like it's, you know, because I think that's something that we can all kind of connect with, is we all go through adolescence. We all go through childhood. We all go through those shitty teenage years. And I think being able to see this grander kind of commentary on things through the lens of like what it's like to also be a teenager, I think it makes him so he's still one of the most underrated filmmakers, screenwriters, you know, of our era, for sure. I want to ask this big question next then, Shane. So why Some Kind of Wonderful? What is it about this movie that has such an impact for you?
So let's go. Breakfast Club was my all-time favorite movie, and yeah. I loved it. I at different times during my adolescence, I was all five of those people in detention. Mm-hmm. So I got that one. I fell in love with Molly Ringwald and married a Molly Ringwald. I married a beautiful redhead. I chased Molly my whole life and married one. So 16 candles. And then I followed her into Pretty in Pink. I was so pissed at the end of Pretty in Pink. Like, how dare she not end up with Ducky? I was so freaking pissed at her. That when Some Kind of Wonderful came out, and can I do spoilers on this or not? Can I?
Yes. Okay. Go for it.
So when the poor working class guy ends up with the poor working class girl, it was the perfect ending. You know, not everybody's going to have fuck the Brothers Grimm and fairy tales and all that shit. Very rarely do you get a glass slipper and marry the fucking prince. Okay. Very rarely does the beautiful princess stumble into a swamp and kiss a frog. Okay. Usually we date within our class. And I thought that was so realistic. Normally we, you know, sure. We dabble and we rise. And I hope that love isn't defined by socioeconomic or race or any of that stuff. I hope it's not. I'm also a realist, right?
Right.
I'm also a realist. And you know, so the kid who works in the garage, fall in love with the poor little drummer girl that they grew up neighbors in this rough and tumble part of town, even though Amanda's from that part of town too, but she was aspiring to greater things, by the way. But for those two to end up together the way that it should have happened in Pretty in Pink just cemented it as probably my second favorite Hughes film. And plus, where else do you get a skinhead as a chauffeur?
Yeah. Elias Koteas in this movie is just wonderful. Like, I love him in general. He is my Casey Jones, of course. But seeing him in this movie, because I had never seen this movie before you suggested it. And it's one of those that's been on my watch list forever. And it's like, it's one of those John Hughes movies that I have missed for some reason. So watching this for the first time the other night was just wonderful. Just a really good time. And seeing him pop up as that skinhead character, I was like, oh,
as he's carving into the detention desk. It's so fantastic.
I have never been more like happy with a resolution than I was when he and his friends come walking through the door of the party. Oh, I was like, yes, yes, this pays off everything.
Can we talk about how good Craig Schaefer was?
Oh, man.
I mean, so he's a very underrated actor, and we could spend hours just diving into his catalog. He encompasses, he's one of those, and I don't know if he's a method actor, but he really, on the screen at least, becomes the role. And he was such a smarmy little prick that, yes, when Duncan and his crew walk into his little party where he's planning to, you know, publicly humiliate Keith, and they walk in and save the day. There was cheers at the Brookings Twin Theater where I saw it when it first opened. There were cheers, you know, as I sat there with high school and college kids seeing this John Hughes movie, because every one of us wanted a Duncan, because we've all been in that position where we felt socially awkward and ambushed, and we have the courage to stand up and I'm going to face whatever. Thank God I don't have to, though, because I have these muckraking, you know, like basically you had the Dropkick Murphys walking into half your back.
Right. You kind of touched upon it, but do you remember your experience, like the first time that you saw this movie? Was that at that Brookings Theater?
Yeah,
like,
it was at the Brookings
Theater. Was the whole movie electric?
I remember people, I vividly remember people, the shower scene where Keith is singing Miss Amanda Jones into the, you know, using the shower head as a microphone. And I specifically remember the feeling of people moving in their seats, you know, and going along with it. And you know, you get that John Hughes has a very interesting, even though he wasn't the director here, he was the writer, but his imprint is very much on it with the bright. You very rarely see a dark John Hughes filmed movie. It's all very bright and this, you know, panoramic down to zoom. Think about Ferris Bueller, think about all of it. Breakfast Club is all boom, into a point. And yeah, I remember there being, and like I say, the cheering there, the applauding, and the applauding at the end of Drummer Girl and Keith getting together. It was actual applause, you know. I remember that. And then I had a number of John Hughes drinking parties in college, you know, where you draw a trope from the hat, and every time that trope happened, you had to drink. By the way, we also did that with Wizard of Oz, and you never wanted to get follow as your word. That's a lot of shots.
No, that's Andy, bad.
That's a lot of shots. Follow the yellow brick
road. That's bad news.
Follow the. It's 8 shots every fucking time they sing that song. You don't make it. You don't make it to Oz.
That's not. Nope.
But yeah, so
I would be out.
It was a great feeling. And then my little clan of this group that I was really tight with and remain close with, we all kind of thought ourselves John Hughes kids. We really did. I mean, for my generation at 54, for Gen X, so many of us saw ourselves as John Hughes kids. And Hughes had this. Here's another thing that I think resonated with the audience, and especially with me, with Some Kind of Wonderful in particular. It's sweet, but it's not cloyingly sweet.
Yes.
It's not sickeningly sweet. It's realistic. You know, my dad would have kicked my ass if I'd have spent my college fund on a pair of earrings. But I did that. I didn't, maybe they weren't diamond, but I spent money that I couldn't afford to impress a girl. I get it. I freaking get it. We've all done it. So it was, it didn't feel sickeningly sweet, but Hughes had this. Hughes' dialogue sounded like the way my friends and I talked to each other.
Yeah.
It never felt like an actor saying a script. It felt like the way my friends and I actually talked, you know, which was great. It's wonderful. I don't know if any of us would have been smart enough or suave enough to say, "You look good wearing my future," which is, you know, the culminative line, you know. I don't know if any of us would have been that smooth, but you know, that's obviously a great takeout line. You know, that's there with, you know, from Singles, "I was just nowhere near the neighborhood," or, you know, Jerry Maguire, "You complete me." I mean, these are great lines, right? It's not really how most people talk, but the rest of the dialogue felt very familiar. It felt like 1980s SDSU. It felt like, you know, my people.
And I feel like there are just a lot of movies that overdo references to things in pop culture at that time. When you go back and watch them years later, they feel very dated because of those references, because there are things that are kind of like, mm-hmm. I don't get this. This doesn't click. But I feel right. like this movie, and most of John Hughes movies, they reference just enough where it's like, okay, this is a movie from the 80s, but it doesn't feel so one track, where it's like, this is clearly a movie that only people in the 80s can relate to. Right, there's right. a universality to it that I think, luckily, when they don't overdo references, it kind of stands above that. What is it for you about this movie that really, I guess, kind of stands out as something that makes it, you know, I wonder if it's the gives it its heart, that gives it its sure. The reason why it's still a movie that feels relevant to people today. What is it that stands out from this movie for you?
I think there's a very realistic portrayal of romantic, platonic, and family love. I think very realistic. I think that you know what's really cool about this one, which is very different than the parental units in 16 Candles, is that the parents feel real in this one. And I think he got better at that. I also think the parents feel real and Pretty in Pink. But Keith's dad feels like a dad here. And that conflict out of love and out of wanting better for the next generation, God, that feels real. That feels like a father-son relationship. And then the platonic love of Keith and Drummer, you know, although it becomes romantic, but it really portrayed, and I think personally it resonated with me because I had a number of female friends and still do, but I had a number of female friends growing up that I was very close with. Now kids call it friend zone, whatever. You know, I had crushes on a couple of them, but they were just really just friends, you know? And so that resonated with me. Having a female best friend felt just fine to me. And the amount of shit they give each other, the pain as you see someone making a wrong choice, but hey, I'm your friend, so I'm going to be loyal to you regardless.
Yeah.
I mean, how many of us have done that? Like, and then afterwards going, she was no good for you anyway, right? You know, but at the time we're like, you go, bro, this is totally going to work.
I got your back.
right. You know, and then romantic love, I felt like it was very realistic in both this portrayal of romantic betrayal between Craig Schaefer and Leah Thompson, between Amanda and God, well, I can't think of Craig Schaefer's characters. I thought it was very real there. And this longing desire to belong. And then also in the courtship of Miss Amanda Jones by Keith, and then Watts, Drummer Girl, and Keith's romance finally blossoming at the end. I thought it really, I think love, loyalty, and honor are three things that really stand out in that movie. You know, Duncan is this very loyal. I mean, he could be, you know, he's the Southern gentleman. You know, I mean, honestly, he's a thug. You know, I know that terminology brings a lot of different things, good connotations to mind, but he's this thuggish oaf, but has wonderful manners. He's very kind. He's very respect and loyalty and honor mean something to him.
Yeah. You know,
so even his love, this brotherly love of, you know, I got you, bro, you know, kumbaya, that's fucking real, you know?
Yeah, it's so funny because it's like there's the scene where he compliments Amanda Jones' legs. You know, they walk into the museum and he's like, yeah, she's got great legs. And instead of being like, yeah, I'm going to hit on her, he's like, way to go, buddy.
right. It doesn't seem sexist, does it? It doesn't seem degrading at all. It's just like, dude, she's got a great pair of sticks there, man. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, even Watts begrudgingly, you know, admits her beauty and I can see why you'd want to be with her, but she, you know, she's going to break your heart, Keith, you know, she sees it. But she also can see, I would go for her too, you know? Good for you, kid.
It's so much of this movie feels like the realistic approach to having a crush on someone that's out of your league, but still getting a chance. Because it's like, you know, we see those movies all the time. It's like the loser falls for the popular girl, and then it's like this you said the Brothers Grimm earlier, but it does have this kind of like fairy tale esque where everything lines up so perfectly, and of course they're destined to be together, and in the end they ride off into the sunset together happily ever after. This one is like Keith and Amanda Jones. We'll talk about that relationship first. It's like every step of the way, it's like, why are these two gonna hook up? There's no way these two are gonna hook up. And then they get together and it's like, oh, well, this feels like two people who've kind of finally come together. Like they finally see each other. And it took, like, you know, him thinking that she was out to get him, but he still wanted to prove himself to her before it finally clicked that, like, yeah, he does have value. I see good in him that I wouldn't mind being with. But ultimately,
it's Camelot, you know, it's a knight's quest.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was no doubt the outcome. He was going to fall on the sword. He just never stopped pursuing his grail, which was Amanda Jones, to the point where she had to acknowledge it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then at the end, you know, when she kind of realizes that the right fit is going to be him and his best friend, like they click. Like they have a care for each other that it's taking him a while to see, but, you know, Amanda can already see the drummer has for him. And I just think it really comes together really nicely. I even would have wanted a little bit more just to see a little bit more of them together, but I think that's because I like them so much. These characters are so likable that I want more of their story.
Dude, and as a late teens boy, when this came out, I wanted Amanda Jones, but I was in love with Watts.
Yeah. Right?
I was just like Keith, man. I wanted Amanda Jones, right? Everybody wanted to show up at the party with Amanda Jones, right? But what you really wanted was someone like Watts. You wanted someone who was going to call you on your bullshit, have your back. I mean, that's what you wanted. God, that opening scene of Watts on the drums as it just builds and builds is it's spectacular. I mean, it just, you, when you first meet her, you're like, oh, she's angry, but she's not. She's hurt.
Right.
She's hurt. Yeah. She's been, you know, this is who you are, and high school is, this is all you can be. And, you know, I mean, they make jokes about her sexuality, you know, and on. And so she's angry because I love what you said. They see each other. Nobody sees Watts. Nobody sees Watts until Keith sees her at the end. We as the audience see her, but in that John Hughes world, she's not seen at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to, when we talked beforehand about, you know, that this is kind of the, a gender swapped Pretty in Pink. I think it, you know, definitely to an extent it sure is, but I think the thing with Pretty in Pink is that you unfairly never think that Ducky really has a chance. Like, but it's always between Andrew McCarthy or James Spader, and Ducky is just kind of off to the side. But watching this one, you feel like, and I don't know, maybe it's just because I like tough girls, like the drummer, like I like his best friend, that it's like, oh, well, there's a good chance here that either one of these women he can end up with by the end of the movie, and it would make perfect sense because, you know, Leah Thompson is Leah Thompson, like 1980s Leah Thompson in a movie. That's all you have to say. But, you know, you get this girl who is just like, gets him, like just understands him, cares about him, and is there, his like, his better half, like will give him the shit that he gives back. Like their rapport is so great that it's like, I buy either one of these. And I wonder why it is that in this situation, the loser is the one who, it's like, you know, you can believe it would happen, and Pretty in Pink, it's not as believable, is it?
Because Ducky is never viewed as heroic. Watts is viewed as heroic through her sacrifice. Ducky is the court jester. And always the court jester. Watts is the second. Watts is Galahad backing Lancelot. Ducky's comic relief. And you know that Ducky's going to have his heart broken, and you know that Ducky's going to laugh through his tears. Meanwhile, drummer girl Watts, you feel her pain. And I think it's because the heartbreak and the sacrifice is so realistically written that you have immediate empathy and understanding for it.
Yeah.
Right. I think that that's part of it. And I could be over analyzing it. I don't know what Hughes
meant. That's what we do here sometimes.
But I feel like, you know, because it is kind of gender swapped and purposely made so that he could rectify you know, the hot redhead ending up with the downtrodden instead of the uprising, you know?
Yeah.
And we got teased that in Breakfast Club, right? We got teased that,
right,
you know, with Judd and Molly in Breakfast Club, but just teased, you know?
Yeah.
An earring in the fist. And we, you know, probably what's more realistic is the fact that they didn't talk to each other on Monday in the hallways. That's probably more realistic is that they all went back to their miserable lives and nobody paid attention to each other.
Yeah.
So it's that played out in Some Kind of Wonderful as well. So all these different themes, you know, played out. And I think the culmination of it was Some Kind of Wonderful, you know, and it should be. Did you know that he wrote the role of Amanda for Molly?
I didn't know that, but I wouldn't have been surprised just because of how well they work together, how much that it feels like she understood his writing and he understood her as an actress. But I'm kind of glad that it wasn't, like, just because I like Leah Thompson a lot from that era. Like, I just think she, even in
Howard the Duck,
even in Howard the Duck, she is a lot of fun. She has a good time. She understands the assignment, as the kids would say.
She was third cast. It went Molly Ringwald, Dana Delaney.
Really?
Yep. And then finally, Leah Thompson.
Dana and Kyle Delaney, huh?
Yeah, and Kyle MacLachlan was supposed to play Craig Schaefer's role.
Wow. Yeah. I don't know if I'd buy that.
right, either of them,
But maybe that's because I'm coming from now. And I think when I think of Kyle MacLachlan, I think of like Twin Peaks. I think of his character in Sex and the City. So it's like, I don't know that.
I think he could have done Smarmy Asshole, but I don't know if I'd have bought the smoldering, you know, I'm going to do anything to have this guy like Craig Schaefer. Craig Schaefer was beautiful in this movie, by the way. I mean, holy smokes.
Yeah.
You know,
he was just drop dead sculpted gorgeous. By the gods.
yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and, you know, yeah, it was, dude. And weird little cameos in the cast, like, what's her butt from Full House playing it? Keith's little sister. Cameron, what's her name?
Candace Cameron.
Thank you. And then China Phillips from Wilson Phillips.
Yeah, right. As the girl that he cheated very clearly, very obviously. that was where I was like, what? How? She's not gonna buy it for a second, buddy. what are you thinking?
It was so it just little, like, pretty cool casting too. John Ashton as the dad.
Oh man, watching him, I was like, I love Beverly Hills Cop. I love Beverly Hills Cop so much.
Yeah, and it was, like I say, that was a very realistic portrayal of father and son.
Yeah.
I just thought it resonated, you know, it really did.
A really great relationship between working class father and son, especially because it's like you get that, he always conveyed that struggle of like, I want to see my son do better.
So. I love that. I love that you know, Keith just conveys, but Dad, you're just fine. What's the matter with being you?
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Isn't that great? You know, it's like, yeah, I get your dreams, Dad, but would it be so bad to just be you? Who's a great father, who raised me, who, you know, who's a good example. Why do I have to be, you know, that? Why can't I just be you? Yeah. I thought, yeah, it's just really smart messaging, really cool. Great soundtrack. Great soundtrack, man.
Yeah.
Lick the Tins. I don't know if they did anything else ever, but their version of Can't Help Falling in Love was on every mixtape that I made from that point forward until about 1996. So every mixtape for every girl I fell in love with had Lick the Tins version of Elvis's Can't Help Falling in Love with You. It's a great version. The whole the soundtrack, and Hughes was great for that. Hughes movies have great soundtracks, fantastic soundtracks. But this one I thought was I owned it. I had to go out and buy the vinyl for it. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I want to ask one question then, because I watched this whole movie called Some Kind of Wonderful and was just devastated by the fact that Some Kind of Wonderful doesn't appear in the movie at all. Is it on the soundtrack?
It is not. And I don't know if you couldn't get the rights to Grand Funk, you know, because so many of them, what he did on this one is, you know, like he doesn't do the Rolling Stones version of Amanda Jones. He doesn't do Elvis's Can't Help Falling in Love. He doesn't do the, and I don't even remember who did it. The center is, I go crazy when I look in your eyes. He doesn't, he takes these unknown up and coming bands and says, you do your version of this. So maybe he just couldn't get Grand Funk's Some Kind of Wonderful, which is a fantastic song. And when I was DJing, when I was Kelly Wilde, W-Y-L-D-E, driving all the ladies wild, for KKLS, that was my opening song with Some Kind of Wonderful. As I was getting the crowd going, that's the first song I would play every shitty small town bar I went and played in. I didn't do it for like proms or weddings, but that was my opening. Wednesday nights I was at Shenanigans, Thursday night I was at Empire Bowl, and then Friday and Saturday I'd be in some small town bar doing a dance, you know, a DJ dance. So that was my opener all the time. I love that song.
Yes, wonderful song. What if you were to recommend this movie to someone who has not had a chance to see it, and you needed to either pull a scene, pull a theme, pull the characters, what would be your selling point behind this movie to convince somebody to watch it?
The limo through the museum.
Yes,
it's such a great scene because you get every character, and that shot, you know, when I'm talking about, when I was talking about Big Scopes a little, the shot between the rearview mirror, Watts as the chauffeur in looking in the rearview mirror, back at Amanda and, you know, hitting the brakes. And then of course you get Duncan, you know, bribing the freaking museum guard and, you know, all of that, you get Keith's earnestness and sweetness and nobility, and you get, and you get Amanda Jones's insecurities and her love of attention, and you get Watts's fierce loyalty, and you get Duncan's morals and values and his brotherhood. So you get a snippet just from the limo through the museum. You know, even as they're sitting out there, as Duncan and Watts are sitting out on the freaking curb, you know. you know, and I think that's just an iconic, there's bigger scenes that other people would probably pick out, the party, the shower, the opening of the drumming, different things, but that little run there, the date before the date, I think is fantastic. I think it's just fantastic.
Just a wonderful snippet of the movie, which, man, great, great choice. Like, I had a lot of fun getting to finally watch this movie. And yeah, it was just a blast. So Shane, thank you so much for chatting with me. We're not quite done yet. I've got one last little section here, and that is what I like to call the Fat Five. They're five rapid fire-ish questions that kind of are a gauge of your taste in movies. So Shane, are you ready for the Fat Five?
I am ready for the Fat Five. Let's do it.
All right. Here we go. Question number one. This is the one where people say they hate me and never want to return to the show again. Question one, what is your favorite movie of all time?
Breakfast Club.
Excellent. Excellent choice. Yeah. Love that movie so much. Question two is a two-parter. The first part is, who is your favorite actor, favorite male performer?
Kevin Costner. Awesome. I've loved everything he's done from, I think the first thing I saw him in was a really cool little, really cool Western called Silverado. I might've seen him in other things in the background before that, but he played this loopy wild character in Silverado about 1985. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful Western. And dude, he's done great baseball movies, and I'm a baseball junkie, man. So I love Costner, man. I just, everything he does, I've loved. So Kevin Costner.
Oh, yeah, awesome choice. Underrated on the show, not given the love and respect that he needs by people when I ask that question. I also love Kevin Costner. Flip side of that then, favorite actress, favorite female performer?
Oh wow. Because there's a bunch that are coming to mind. So,
this one's always tougher. This is the one that
because I have like three, and do I just go one genre and go Jamie Lee Curtis? Cause I can just do that. And it's not just one genre, cause she did so much and I could go my dear beloved Molly Ringwald, probably my favorite of all time, though, is probably just because she's a freaking powerhouse, is Tilda Swinton.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She is a powerhouse. And it's, so, you know, people talk about Meryl Streep and, you know, all the different, Tilda Swinton is probably this generation's Meryl Streep.
Mm-hmm.
This movie generation's, you know, I'm not speaking of Gen Y or Gen Z or whatever, just this movie generation's Meryl Streep.
Yeah. She's willing fantastic. To make like bold choices. Like, I just love it. Love watching.
And could win the Academy Award for every role that she plays, every single role that she plays, she could be nominated and win. Same as Meryl Streep in the 80s and 90s, every role.
Yeah.
Every role. Yeah.
Yeah. Nope. Totally agree. Yeah. Awesome choice. Question number three, probably should be, who's your favorite director? But I like to ask it a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. Is there a director that if they had a movie coming out tomorrow, you wouldn't need to see a trailer, wouldn't need to know cast, wouldn't need to know? Wes Anderson? Awesome.
Yep.
Awesome.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Sight unseen. As much as I've watched John Hughes movies, I've probably watched Wes Anderson movies more. And I've watched all of John Hughes movies roughly 1,042,000,000 times. So that means I've watched Wes Anderson's movies 1,043,000,000. It got to the point where people wouldn't watch The Breakfast Club with me, and it's gotten to the point where nobody will watch Grand Budapest with me. So,
Are you a quoter? Do you quote it as it goes along?
I can.
Yeah. I get that.
I love that. Yes, yeah. I get very excited.
If you're watching it with somebody who's never seen it before, you're like, hey, pay attention to this.
This is really important. Yeah, you don't want me as your tour guide on first time movie. No.
Oh, good choice. Question four. Is there a movie scheduled to come out that you are excited to see, or a movie that has already come out that you haven't had a chance to see yet, that as soon as you get that opportunity, you're excited to see? So something upcoming you're excited about.
May 5th.
Yeah, Guardians 3.
Yeah. He's going to kill the whole cast. The whole cast is going to go into the multiverse and disappear, and I'm going to bawl like a baby. He's gonna pull a freaking firefly on us, and he's gonna, you know, I am a leaf in the thump. Something's gonna happen that tragically. He's gonna do something to us, and I don't think it's just gonna be one of them. I think it's gonna be all of them. I think he's gonna kill the whole damn cast. It just makes, yeah, it makes ugly sense, and I'm so excited for it. The whole family is. We will be there opening night, and Derek is very disappointed because he just got braces put on Monday, and he can't have popcorn for a while. And he usually does a bucket of popcorn himself, so so I'm going to sit right next to him and slowly eat popcorn because I'm that asshole.
I just kind of look at him.
Yep, yep, for sure.
This is so good.
Oh, smell.
Yeah, I am also really excited for that. I was looking through Cinemark's website today because I'm going to probably go to some movies this week, and I saw that tickets are available for Guardians of the Galaxy, so I might have to scoop mine up too. So really, really excited for that one. Just
we have a bunch we need to catch up on about Disney Plus. A bunch we have to catch up on Disney Plus. Like, we've seen all the Marvel ones, but we're behind on Pixar ones. We're like three behind Pixar ones. So we need to catch up on those. Yeah, so, you know, life happens and you're like, I need to see this, and then we don't, but we will be butts in the seat for opening night of Galaxy.
So. Yep. I think same here. I have missed the last few Marvel movies, but I think that'll be one that'll get me back in there for opening night. So
cool.
Super pumped. Last question then, Shane, is the name of the show is Let's Talk About. I use a taco scale when I rate my movies. So, Shane, I would like for me to craft your perfect taco. What kind of shell are we using? What's our protein? Make a delicious taco for me.
Okay. Corn tortilla, flaky fried haddock, pickled radishes, pickled jalapeno, shreddis. You know, the shredded lettuce, and probably a really good garlic aioli. I'm a big sucker for the fish taco. I love the fish taco. Gilberto's fish taco is fantastic. But yeah, give me that corn tortilla. Give me a hot, piping, lightly fried haddock fish inside of that. Some really good acidic radishes, a little spicy jalapeno. And then some lettuce to cool with an aioli on top. I'm all in. I'm all done, man.
Oh, I am so glad it's dinner time. time to go get some food. Shane, I cannot thank you enough. This has been just an absolute blast for me. Thanks for taking some time out of your day to chat with me. If people wanted to find you online or find SuperCon information out online, where can they go?
So, I go by my full real name on all social media. I stand behind what I say, so I don't use a false name. I don't have a, maybe I just wasn't smart enough to come up with a crafty handle, but I am Shane Gerlach, Gerlach on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, on TikTok, on LinkedIn, on all the social media. SuperCon is SIOUX Percon, SuperCon, and you can go to supercon.com. You can find us also on all the socials. Follow us, you know, and we make announcements frequently of really cool stuff we have coming up. If you see a long-winded post on SuperCon Facebook page, that's me. My social media people are really good and they pop stuff out. If you see something long and rambling, it's me, as you probably learned by watching this. So, but otherwise, yeah, you can follow me on social media. I always follow back. I talk geek stuff. I am an advocate, and every once in a while I share a funny meme.
Yeah. Shane, just a blast. Like, just thank you. This was so much fun for me. So thank you for joining me to have a conversation.
It's been wonderful. This has been great. I love this stuff, man.
Once again, a huge, huge thank you to Shane Gerlach for that great interview. Like, just, I don't know. I really... It's so funny. I feel like now I say this every week and nobody ever says anything back to me. So I don't know if people get sick and tired of hearing it or what, but I always love talking to people that I've never talked to before. I love talking to my friends. Don't get me wrong. I can have, you know, people that I'm really close with on the show all the time. And I frequently do. But there's just some kind of joy of like getting to have that first kind of getting to know you conversation that I have a lot of fun with. So This podcast has been super cool for getting the opportunities to chat with people. So, yeah, a huge thanks to Shane. And that's going to do it for this week's episode of the show. You can follow all things Fat Dude Digs Flicks on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Letterboxd, even the TikTok. Just do a search for Fat Dude Digs Flicks and you will find me there. Subscribe to this podcast, like this podcast, rate and review this podcast, share this podcast with your friends. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, anywhere you catch your pods. If you do use Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please leave a rating or a review to let people know that you like the show. I'm going to keep doing this show until I get tired of it, or, you know, maybe there will be a week here or there where I don't do the show. It's not because I'm tired of the show. It's just because I'm tired. So I'm going to take a break. But I'm going to keep doing the show because I'm having a good time with it, and I will keep doing the show until it's not fun anymore. But one thing that would make it even better is to have a bunch of listeners. And the best way to do that is with your help. So again, please leave that rating, leave a review, share this with your friends, let them know that I'm out here doing my thing. If you do subscribe to Let's Talk About, not only do you get this podcast, but you also get the Criterion Break, where I am joined by Derek Viering and Blake Ginnethan, where the three of us discuss our love for the Criterion Collection proper and the Criterion Channel. So definitely listen to that. There'll be a Criterion Break coming up soon, which will deviate a little bit from our mini-series, just because Blake is going on a brief hiatus, but Derek and I still have stuff to talk about. And that'll be coming up here pretty soon. I don't think next week, but it's just around the bend. If you want to be a guest on the show, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, want to start a conversation, whatever, leave a recommendation, leave a donation, anything like that, fatdudediggsflicks@gmail.com. I love talking to people. I love getting recommendations. I love having new guests. Like, I love all that stuff. So please send an email to fatdudediggsflicks@gmail.com. Join the South Dakota Film Community group on Facebook if you live in the South Dakota area or don't live in the South Dakota area, but really like talking about movies. That's the group for you. We love chatting about movies, so definitely join there. I think that's it. I don't know what else I need to plug. I don't know what else I have to talk about. And I, honestly, I don't know if I'll be back next week. Same fat time, same fat channel. I haven't done this on Taco Tuesday in a while. So, sorry. Oops. I'm kind of not fitting the mold. But I'll be back eventually. I'll probably be back next week at some point in time. Certainly on this channel. And let's... When I do that, let's talk about movies. Whenever I come back, whatever day this next episode drops, until then, please be safe. Please take care of yourself. Please take care of your friends, your family, your loved ones. Be good, be safe. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Fat Dude Digs Flicks.